quiet stand. On my mind, the economic toll of the war in Ukraine. It's been nearly 3 months since Russia invaded its neighbor. From the beginning, the unified reaction of the U.S. and European allies was surprisingly strong, implementing dramatic sanctions and offering military aid. But now, as Western economies navigate disrupted supply chains and pipelines, and a crunch on the global wheat supply, there are questions about how much further they can push Russia on the economic battlefield. Sebastian Mallaby is a senior fellow for international economics at the Council on Foreign Relations and a contributing columnist for The Washington Post. His latest book is titled The Power Law. He joined me Thursday morning to talk about the short and long-term economic effects of the conflict. Sebastian, in March, you wrote that the West was winning the economic war with Russia. What did you mean by that, and do you still feel that way?
Diane, it's a great question. What I meant was that the projections for growth in Russia this year were already down to negative 8.5 or 10% or thereabouts. And since growth had been projected before the war as positive 3, that was an enormous swing in Russia's position. And so I still think that Russia is suffering a good deal of pain and loss of prosperity from the sanctions, which is raising the cost to them of prosecuting this war in Ukraine. And so in that sense, I think, yes, the sanctions are still working and the West is still winning this economic battle.
Some have argued that sanctions cannot alone be sufficient to do what needs to be done to turn Russia away from Ukraine, that Ukraine needs more heavy equipment, it needs more training, it needs more money. And as you well know, the president has okayed billions more for help to Ukraine. Will that eventually wear Russia down, or is Putin determined to stay in there till the very end?
Well, I think you're absolutely right that all those military forms of aid are essential. I'm not at all arguing that the economic side, the sanctions side, is enough by itself. It's just one extra tool. You know, as to whether the combination of this military supplies to the Ukrainian army combined with the sanctions on Russia amount to something that are going to drive Putin out of Ukraine altogether, I mean, that's one of those impossible things to know unless you're inside Putin's head. I mean, it does seem as if it's a country where he has sole control. If you look back at the debate that was happening before the invasion of Ukraine, one of the most striking things was that analysts who were very well connected in Moscow, who spoke to the elites in Moscow, the senior officials, the oligarchs and all that, they none of them thought that the invasion would take place because all of them thought it was not in Russia's interest. But Putin did it anyway. I think what that shows us is that it's not just about, you know, the economic pain he suffers, the military losses that he takes. At some level, he may not care. And so I think we have to be realistic in thinking that, you know, we have no guarantee that any of this gets him out of Ukraine. But on the other hand, what's the opposite choice? We can't sit there and do nothing.
You've spoken about the oligarchs, the generals, the higher-ups. What about the people of Russia? To what extent are they beginning to feel the weight of higher prices, less or greater shortage of goods? Are they really beginning to feel this war against Ukraine?
Well, yes, I think, you know, right at the beginning, 70,000 or so skilled Russian workers, many of them in technology, left the country altogether. Large numbers of others have been told, well, you've got capital controls, you can't convert your money into foreign currency anymore. That's not allowed. Imports have dried up very fast. I think it's something like a 35% decline against last year. So what people can access in terms of their consumption basket has been restricted. I think it's fair to say that there are lots of less well-off Russians who basically didn't buy imports and had no thought of going to work abroad. These people may not feel an awful change, although even there, there is inflation, which has been stoked by the sanctions. At one point, this was running at 2% per week. You know, we're worried about 8.5% a year. They've got 2% a week. So I think it's affecting everybody to some degree.
Do you think the fact that it has begun to affect even those at the lower level could have an impact on what Putin decides to continue to do? I mean, for a very long time, he was telling the people that it was Russia who was the victim, and it was Ukraine that was doing all the damage. Do they continue to believe what he is saying, or has doubt begun to creep in to the ordinary population?
Well, there was a viral moment on Russian television just this week where a senior military expert was being interviewed on TV, and to the absolute shock of the, you know, state-run television hosts, he started to tell the truth about how Russian troops were in trouble, the Ukrainian adversaries were serious, they were going to get more Western supplies. And he said, look, we shouldn't live in cloud cuckoo land. We should be realistic that, you know, Russia is having a struggle in this fight, much more than we expected. He kept on saying, this is not a normal situation. And of course, the analysis hitherto had been, well, Putin controls Russian TV. That's what people watch to get their news. And so long as he does that, he can tell whatever lies he wants about the real situation in Ukraine. He can pretend that he's in there to fight so-called Nazis or whatever he likes. And he'll get away with it because he controls the media. But it turns out that that's cracking. So I think it's going to be interesting to watch.
We talked about the sanctions that the U.S. has imposed on Russia. But what about effects on other countries like China, India, and Turkey?
One of the big things is that a new range of sanctions has been rolled out in a more aggressive way than ever before. So freezing another country's central bank reserves was tried a little bit with Iran, but it's a much bigger scale of deal, you know, when you do it with Russia. And I think that sent a signal to other countries, particularly China, that believed before that having $3 trillion or more in foreign currency reserves was a kind of insurance policy against any geopolitical crisis in which they might be subject to sanctions. Turns out it isn't. Turns out that you have foreign reserves. These are held in the Western financial system. And if the West decides to freeze them, you can't use them anymore. And that's a big shock, I think, to China. It's a shock that says, listen, if you want security in China, you're going to have to actually have inside your country all of the potential imports that you might want in a crisis, because just having the foreign currency to buy those imports may not work for you. And that's why I think we've got headlines now about the Chinese buying more Russian oil to stockpile in their strategic petroleum reserve, because they're worried about this kind of thing.
What about the impact on the rest of the world, not only in terms of energy, but other goods as well?
Well, yes, a big factor for the rest of the world is the food export situation. You know, wheat and various other crops, you know, I think something like 35% of the global export market comes from Russia plus Ukraine. And so if you're Egypt and you rely a lot on wheat imports, you've got a problem. If you're Sri Lanka, you've already got a political crisis going on there. Tunisia, one of my Washington Post colleagues went there and reported how desperate the situation was in terms of supplies of bread in the bakeries in Tunisia. We know from the Arab Spring 11 years ago how politically explosive this can be when food prices shoot up. So I think that is a big worry and one which I wish the West would do more about in terms of providing debt relief to these emerging economies. Because if you're in a situation where Western sanctions have driven up food prices for the poor people of North Africa or Sri Lanka or where have you, and then the West does nothing to ameliorate that shock, I think that's going to cost the West a lot in terms of its reputation in the emerging world.
And what about what's happening in this country? A spiraling downward stock market, food prices, gasoline prices, everything on the rise, plus COVID. That trifecta of problems, plus Ukraine.
Yes, I mean, I agree. I think that the impact directly from Ukraine is clearly a lot bigger in Europe because they rely on Russian gas and oil much more than the U.S. does. U.S. doesn't get any gas, I don't think, or hardly any from Russia, and rather little oil. So the effect is bigger in Europe, but it does exist in the U.S. And as you say, Diane, it comes on top of these other factors. You know, there was inflation because of overstimulus during the pandemic, and now the Fed has to raise interest rates to clamp down on that inflation. That's causing stock markets to fall, you know, complete terror in the financial world this week. And, you know, I hope that stabilizes, but we're in for a rough time. People are kind of 50-50 on whether there'll be a U.S. economic recession this year. But I think when we're thinking about the whole Russia-Ukraine crisis and what we should do about it, we ought not to flinch. You know, I mean, if there is a recession, it will be not primarily because of Ukraine or Russia. And if there is a recession, the U.S. will still be suffering an awful lot less than obviously Ukraine or even indeed any frontline state next to Ukraine, which is absorbing, you know, hundreds of thousands of refugees. So, you know, if we want to be serious about geopolitics, which the Biden administration says it does, we have to be willing to take a little bit of pain to do the right thing.
Now a quick break. When we return, the rest of my conversation with Sebastian Mallaby. And we're back. Here's the rest of my conversation with Sebastian Mallaby, senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and contributing columnist at the Washington Post. So with Russia faltering somewhat, is this the best time to tighten the screws on that country?
I do think so. I mean, I think part of the point is that all of these, you know, drawn-out military conflicts are in some sense, you know, contests of attrition. Who's got the stamina to carry on? And when you impose sanctions initially, they have an effect, and then the other side figures out end runs, loopholes, ways around them, and you read about Russian companies relocating to Kazakhstan to avoid sanctions, but then continuing to function, and maybe they'll come back after the war if they can. You read about, you know, Russian companies finding suppliers in Asia or export markets in Asia to replace the ones that they've lost in the West. So if the West just sort of sits there and does nothing further, effectively the sanctions will be eroding in their effectiveness. And I think, therefore, one has to keep on marching forwards just to stay still. And it is worth doing that because we're confronting serious evil in the form of this invasion of Ukraine, and we have to punish that.
I realize you can't get into the head of Mr. Putin, but does Putin believe that the West will falter, that the West will sort of get weary of this kind of downward economic health food crisis, and he's determined just to wait it out?
You know, I think he made that mistake in choosing to go into Ukraine in the first place. I think he calculated that hey, you know, the West just wouldn't have the guts to resist it in any serious way.
To even come in.
Yeah, I mean, he looked at the withdrawal from Afghanistan, the way that the administration was determined to pull out, even if it caused a bit of chaos. And he figured, well, this is a West that's simply not going to push back. And I think that's the cost of a period of not being firm enough in Western foreign policy. Now that he's in Ukraine and the West has pushed back, and it looks as if, you know, Finland and Sweden may join NATO in response to this. So he's actually, you know, Putin has created more of a serious adversary than he had before. And the West has demonstrated its willingness to use very far-reaching sanctions to supply the Ukrainians with rather effective weaponry to resist the Russian assault. I think all of that means that, you know, his miscalculation is exposed, but at the same time, you know, he can't lose face, he thinks, by simply just pulling out. And so we're in this position where neither side wants to duck. I don't think the West should duck. I'm fearful that Putin himself will try to avoid ducking. The result is, you know, a painful, protracted conflict. And you might say, is it worth it? I think one has to ask the Ukrainian people. They seem to think it's worth it. I mean, they're willing to fight, you know, to the death in many cases. And if they're willing to do that, I'm not sure it's right for the West to say otherwise.
It's interesting. I heard this morning on NPR that Ukrainian farmers, where they can, are continuing to farm, knowing that their wheat is very important to the rest of the world. How can they do that in the face of these kinds of attacks from Russia?
It's an extraordinary testament to their courage, isn't it? To plant a crop that won't be harvested for months, and you never know if it will just be trashed
right
by tanks. I mean, I think what's going on is that Ukraine has succeeded rather well militarily in, you know, having control of the west and center of the country. The east is another story. That's, you know, the epicenter of the fighting. And so I'd be surprised if your NPR colleagues were reporting a lot of farming there. But I think in the rest of the country, it seems as though life can go back somewhat to normal. People are able to go out to cafes again. And so that's the hopeful part of what's going on in Ukraine.
What about the question of EU and other countries' unity behind U.S. sanctions? Is that very strong, middling, or beginning to waver?
Well, a difference has opened up over time between Germany and maybe Italy, with Germany on the one hand, and the U.S. on the other. The U.S. has been able to go further in sanctions because it's sort of further away geographically, stronger economically, and just less exposed. The Germans and the Italians are the two major economies that import a lot of Russian gas, and they really fear that there could be a domestic recession if they were to stop buying it. And so there's a limit to how far they're willing to go in sanctions, and that means that they're paying, I think it's, you know, billions of dollars in currency paid to Russia for these gas supplies, which is obviously a huge loophole in the sanctions effort. And so I think there's a bit of tension over that. But, you know, in all geopolitics, alliances are never perfect. And if you kind of measure what's going on against what the expectation might have been before the war, if we had said ahead of time, how unified will Western Europe and the US be, given what we've seen in geopolitics in the last sort of seven or whatever years, you know, this is actually more unified than one might have predicted. There's more solidarity between continental Europe and the US than we've seen for a bit. So I think it's slightly in the middle, to answer your question.
Right now, do you think that the US itself is doing enough to address its own economic woes?
You know, I think the Federal Reserve was late in raising interest rates. It's much easier to fight both an inflation problem and an overvalued stock market if you go early. Now, you know, it was very hard to judge exactly when to tighten, but there was a moment sort of maybe around September, October last year, where I think the balance of risk was that it would be much more risky to do nothing and wait than to move. And they didn't do that. So I think it was a mistake. Now we are where we are. The Fed has belatedly acknowledged that it's got to move. It's done two interest rate hikes. It's promising to do more this year. So that's going to calm inflation down. Plus, part of the inflation is sort of transitory supply bottlenecks. That word transitory was overused last year, but, you know, there's some truth in it. And so I think the likelihood is that inflation is going to come down fairly smoothly towards the end of the year, from around 8% now to maybe 4% or so by the end of the year. And so we'll be on the way towards getting that under control. And I feel okay about that. There's always more things that can be done economically, particularly in favor, in terms of sort of getting the basics of the economy right. I think much more could be done to address social mobility and inequality. I think it's appalling that the estate tax was gutted under George W. Bush and then never really restored in the years since then, because that's just the obvious tax that encourages intergenerational social mobility, and that's a healthy thing for society. You know, I'm always in favor of doing more that encourages innovation and technology. The US is pretty good at that, but you could do more to fund basic science research, particularly in the hard sciences, which get less money than the human sciences. So there are a few things that could be done. But, you know, I'd still rather back the US than any other major economy.
I wonder how this whole episode is or could change the entire world supply chain. Do you see that happening?
Yes. I mean, I think we've had a series of shocks to globalization, starting with the US-China trade wars under Donald Trump, which increased the share of global trade that was under sanction, or rather US trade that was under sanction, from, I think, 3% tariff rate to 15% tariff rate. So that was a big shock to globalization. And then you had the collapse of supply chains because of lockdowns during the pandemic. And now you've got these sanctions. And with the sanctions, you've got the implicit threat that there could be more sanctions in some other geopolitical conflict. And already before this Russia-Ukraine crisis, sanctions had been rising in how much they were being used. And so all of that together means that the world is going to be less globalized. Countries are going to be more desperate to get domestic supply sources locked in. They're going to have strategic petroleum reserves, but also strategic reserves for other commodities, whether it's metals or rare earths or even maybe semiconductor chips or what have you. And that means that the world will be less able to go to the cheapest source of supply for any given good, because of this geopolitical concern of loss of that supply. So the cost of production will go up, inflation will be higher, that will have to be counteracted by central bank interest rates being higher, which means that you'll have less growth. And so I think it's a less good outlook for the world economy because of this heightened geopolitical tension.
Aren't we already seeing countries planning in this direction?
Yes. Already it's the case that the US is speaking with Europe about rare earths and how to get stockpiles of those sorted out so that if China were to try to use that as a pressure point in a conflict, it would be less effective. There's a lot of semiconductor geopolitics where, you know, all kinds of countries want to have semiconductor production domestically to isolate themselves from, you know, the threat of sanctions. So very much this is on policymakers' minds.
last question, and this is somewhat outside the economic realm. Many people have said that if Putin gets backed into a corner, he could do something really desperate, like using a nuclear warhead. Do you believe he is capable of doing that?
That's the hardest question of all. And it's so hard because it's sort of in his head. I take comfort from the fact that all of the sort of intelligence reports that I've heard on a sort of vague, you know, secondhand basis suggest that none of his nuclear rhetoric has been backed up by actual, you know, changes in the posture of the weapons. And that there is a possibility that even if he were to say he wanted to unleash a nuclear strike, that his military would not. So these are not cast iron guarantees that he would never do something crazy, but I'm crossing my fingers and believing that it's very unlikely indeed.
Sebastian Mallaby, thank you so much for joining us.
So nice to be with you, Diane.
Thank you. That was Sebastian Mallaby. He's Senior Fellow for International Economics at the Council on Foreign Relations and a contributing columnist for The Washington Post. His latest book is titled The Power Law, Venture Capital, and the Making of the New Future. And that's all for today. We welcome your feedback and suggestions. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Allison Brody. Our engineer today is Adrian Danhauser. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.